Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is the second hour of the show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for our program. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Back in 1964, a psychiatrist named Eric Byrne published a book that he titled Games People Play. This was a book about social interactions among people, people who are related and people who are strangers. And what it is he argues in this book is that these interactions are governed by rules, and they have very predictable outcomes. These were the games people played in social relationships. That's what the title refers to. This is a book that was a huge bestseller. It was very popular. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Dario Maestropieri. He studies human and primate social behavior. And one of the things that he argues in a new book that he has authored that he titles Games Primates Play, one of the things that he argues is that primates play the same games in their social relationships that humans do. And in fact, he argues that these games that we play, we did not invent. We came by them honestly. The book is out recently. It's published by BASIC. Our guest, Dario Maestropieri, is professor of comparative human development, evolutionary biology, neurobiology, and psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at the University of Chicago, and has done a lot of writing and speaking on this particular subject, has talked quite a bit in interviews and elsewhere about the book, and we're really pleased that he could spend some time talking with us this morning. He is in a studio at the University of Chicago, so we have a clear, high-quality connection with him. We're really pleased about that. And as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number. You may also send us an email if you'd like to do it that way, send your question that way, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, you certainly are welcome to call. And Professor Maestropieri, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
You know, I have been thinking about this, and I don't want to oversimplify, but I think that the thing that comes through very clearly here is that human beings are social animals. And like other social animals, we are very attuned to our place in the group. A lot of our behaviors have to do with establishing dominance and also with managing conflict and also with forming alliances, both for romance and for business. And that's very true of human behavior, and that's also very true of primate behavior.
That's correct. Human beings, as you said, are highly social animals, and we live in very complex and very competitive societies, in which if you want to survive and be successful, you need to make friends, you need to cooperate with others, and also you need to watch your back from enemies. So you need to understand all the subtleties of cooperation and competition in these complex societies.
In fact, you I think in the book you actually write that it is our social interactions that reveal our true nature.
Yeah, I think human nature is mainly expressed in human social behavior. Obviously, the human mind has so much potential. We have the ability to engage in abstract thinking, to think about the universe, religion, to think about spirituality, the ability to create art. So all these things set us apart from other animals. But when it comes to social relationships, when it comes to dealing with the problems that arise from everyday social life, we really didn't invent anything new. So we tend to use solutions that have worked for much of our evolutionary history and that are shared by other primate species.
Yeah. Well, we can start out talking about some examples, and I think that this serves to remind people that as much as we like to emphasize the differences between humans and other animals, that in many respects our programming is the same. And this is in the right away in the book you start talking about issues of dominance. And I think the thing I'm sure that you always talk about that people ask you about, and it's something that everyone can relate to, is elevator behavior. And what happens when you find yourself in this small confined space with somebody else that you don't know?
Yeah, at the time I started writing this book, I lived in a high-rise building in Chicago on the 22nd floor of this apartment building. And so every day I took the elevator twice. And because this was a large building with many different apartments, I inevitably met somebody I hadn't met before in the elevator. And I'm sure this is a common situation. All of us have found ourselves in an elevator with a stranger or other people that we don't know. And it's clear that in these situations, we do everything we possibly can to avoid making eye contact with the other person or talking or make any movements that might annoy or upset the other person. So we try to act indifferent. We checked our watch to see the time, even though we already know what time it is. Sometimes we press a button for a floor that's already been pressed. So why do we do all these things? So I observed people's behavior in this elevator, my own behavior, and there were already some explanations as to why people behave that way in elevators, but I wasn't convinced, and so I tried to come up with a different explanation.
This is one of those things that I'm sure that people find difficult to understand because they would say, well, you know, in most cases you get into an elevator with another person unless perhaps there's something very odd or disturbing about them. If it's in an office building and everybody's dressed for work and they don't look particularly threatening, you have to on some level know with some level of confidence this person is not going to attack you once the door's closed. And yet, we can't seem to quite rise above that.
Right. There are so obviously, elevators are a relatively recent invention in human history, and so they present a new situation. But there are many elements of the situation that are not new at all from an evolutionary perspective. So, for example, being in a close, restricted space with a stranger. So having to decide whether to make eye contact or not, whether to start an interaction or not. These are situations that other highly social primates have to deal with. So, for example, in monkey language, making eye contact, staring somebody, is a threat. Mm-hmm. So we unconsciously avoid to make eye contact in the elevator because our mind knows unconsciously that this could be potentially perceived as a threat. So we don't want to stare somebody in their eyes that we don't know. And similarly, we do other things that that essentially, even though there is really zero risk of being attacked, of having a fight in the elevator, we unconsciously do things. We take precautions to minimize this risk of fighting.
Mm-hmm. That's and what I think is interesting here, particularly since, you know, from time to time, over time, people have made these arguments about how human beings are so fundamentally aggressive. And we see stories all of the time about violence visited by one person against another, that there are a lot of things we do in our social interactions that are designed to minimize or to avoid the possibility of conflict.
Correct. So human beings have a high potential for aggression. But whether or not this potential is actually realized depends on many things. One is the environment, the context in which we meet other people, whether we know these people, whether there is an audience or not, whether there is other people watching and judging or maybe participating. And also our own behavior, as you said, because we're highly social creatures and we need the people that live around us. We can't just go around and eliminate the people that we don't like or just go around and pick fights. Fighting is costly and has many negative consequences. And so we are well equipped with behaviors that function to reduce the risk of fighting. And we automatically engage in these behaviors in situations such as an elevator ride in which we perceive that there is risk of aggression.
Yeah. Primates engage in something that's called social grooming, which is a kind of behavior that is designed to establish bonds between two individuals. And it's interesting that your argument that is also that there are things that people do that are analogous to the kind of social grooming that primates engage in.
Yeah, we use language for similar functions. The way we maintain relationships, the way we gather information about third parties through gossip, essentially language is something that allows us to interact with people that we know. Usually, if the interaction is friendly, we establish a bond. We have to talk and communicate with people with whom we have relationships to maintain these bonds. So essentially, we use language for the same functions that in other primates are grooming really serves.
Yeah, and it's one, and you can see if you observe this kind of behavior in primates by looking at who initiates this, who grooms whom, how long do they do it. And so forth, you can see the hierarchical relationships between the individuals. And what's interesting is that, going back to this idea that perhaps for us language is in effect social grooming, one of the things that you've looked at is emails and how it is that some of those same status relationships are embodied in how it is that people write to each other via the computer.
Yeah, so you have to think that for much of our evolutionary history, we interacted with people that we could see, that we could hear, that we could touch. So we maintained relationships with people who were close to us. But these days, many of us maintain social relationships mainly through email or Facebook or other social media. So we maintain relationships with people that we don't see, that we can't hear, and that we can't touch. So the question that sort of came to my mind one day was, as this change in the way we maintain relationships, the fact that we use email, for example, has this altered in some fundamental way the way we manage our relationships? And then as I started thinking about, for example, the way emails are exchanged between two people, I came to the realization that not everything has changed, that you can detect some social dynamics in the way email exchanged that are shared, for example, by other primates' behavior. So let me give you an example. You mentioned that there's always a dominance component in a relationship between two individuals. So there is one individual who is dominant and one who is subordinate. Mm. And this implies that there's different costs and benefits in an interaction between these two individuals. So when it comes to grooming in primates, for example, the subordinate individual has more to benefit from the grooming interaction, and the dominant has less to benefit, and the cost is a little bit higher. So this means that the subordinate is willing to do most of the work. So typically it's the subordinate who initiates the grooming, grooms for longer periods of time, resumes grooming more quickly after an interruption, whereas the dominant is less likely to start and more likely to end. So you can see the same pattern in the way two people exchange emails. I used in my book the example of an hypothetical email exchange between a student and her advisor, her professor. And so typically, the conversation, the email exchange, begins with a student sending the professor a long email in which she asks all kinds of questions or requests information. The professor waits a while before he responds. Then he responds, providing all the information, answering the questions. But the reply is obviously a lot shorter than the original email. Then the student is very encouraged by the response of her advisor, and so sends another email that's even longer with more questions, more requests for information. This time the professor waits until the next day, sends an even shorter email, and so the email exchange goes back and forth, where the professor essentially is increasingly slow in replying. His replies are increasingly short, and in the end, he will not reply anymore. He'll let the last email sit indefinitely, and that will be the end of the conversation. This is exactly the way grooming is exchanged between two individuals, with the subordinate starting the grooming, doing most of the work, and the dominant being reluctant to respond, responding with short bouts, and eventually just getting up and walking away.
You make the argument, and certainly other people who do behavioral economics make this argument, that says that in people's human relationships, they're always making, whether they're aware of it or not, they're always making a kind of a calculation. And they are saying to themselves, in effect, what am I getting here and what is it costing me? And that people, no matter what they're doing, what they're trying to do is they're trying to maximize their benefit and minimize their cost. And so I guess you could see that in dominance behavior is what that's about, is in establishing dominant, it's maximizing my benefit and minimizing my cost, and that people are always weighing that up. But that, how is that truly, do you think, that it's that this kind of behavior, dominance and submissive behavior, did in fact develop in service of that other drive, that is to, you know, maximize your benefits and minimize your costs?
I think there's a simple explanation as to why dominance evolved. I use this example in my book. Imagine that Yogi Bear and Boo Boo Bear, two well-known cartoon characters, meet in the middle of the forest one day, and they see an apple, and they're both hungry. They both want the apple, but the apple cannot be shared. So they have to. Each bear has two options. They can either threaten the other bear, threaten to escalate the confrontation to a fight to try and get the apple, or they can behave submissively, essentially let the other bear take the apple. Now, if both bear threaten each other, so in the language of game theory, this is called the hawk move. So if they both play hawk, there's going to be a fight, okay? If they both play submissively, so if they both play the dove move in game theory language, there's going to be negotiation as to who will get the apple. And then there is a third outcome, which is one in which one bear plays hawk and the other one plays dove. So the one who plays hawk, essentially who threatens the other bear, will get the apple and the other one will not get it. So this is dominance, essentially. It's a way of resolving a disagreement, a conflict of interest, by one individual acting tough, essentially threatening to escalate a fight, and the other one not challenging the other. So why does dominance evolve? Because it would be very expensive and counterproductive to try and resolve all disagreements either through fighting or negotiation. So fighting is very risky, very dangerous, very disruptive of social relationship. If you had a fight every time you had a disagreement with your spouse or with your children, it would be hard to maintain these relationships. Negotiations, too, is very stressful and not always conducive to a satisfactory resolution of the agreement. So dominance instead is a situation in which one individual always calls the shots. So that reduces time and energy and costs. So essentially you have a way of resolving disagreements that is more cost effective than either fighting or negotiation. That's why dominance evolved. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dario Maestropieri. He is professor of comparative human development and evolutionary biology at the University of Chicago. He is interested in the social behavior of humans and also of primates, and he writes about the parallels between those two in his recent book, Games Primates Play, and it is published by Basic Books. Questions are welcome. In fact, we have someone here who'd like to join in the conversation. We'd be happy to do that. Others who are listening can call in, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And the email is will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller in Effingham. We'll talk with them. This is line four. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Your guest gave a bit of a summation there, a microcosm of the conflicts, if I understood it properly, over an apple. Well, if that is between ordinary animals, I think you used the term, the example of bears, you know, which are a larger species, and the relationship that evolved over the apple among the same species. Well, what created that? Why were they hungry? Why were they isolated in a pair where one female, one male, was the other a partially grown? The social content of that's what I'm trying to drive at is the social content of his example. Then transfer that over to Homo sapiens and the present state of human relations around the world over a plethora of conflicts that end in mass murder, armies fighting each other, bombs, germs, you name it. I mean, if it can be used to defeat an enemy, within the same species on a massive scale that we have nowadays, where and how did that evolve? Was it truly an apple between two Homo sapiens or a them or some conflict that could not be resolved in any way except to power the opposition? And then the one becomes subject and the other becomes dominant. Well, if that is the case, where are we headed, and where is all this going to end? Thank you.
Well, the caller raises an interesting question that goes beyond relations between individuals, and now we're talking about relations between groups of individuals.
Yes. Well, let me say that the principles that explain dominance are essentially the same, whether we're discussing dominance in animals or in humans. So, obviously, I gave a simple example to really describe what dominance is about. But as the listener said, things are complex. So, for example, let's go back to the example of the two bears. To determine which bear, for example, will play hawk and threaten the other, and which bear will play submissively, there is other information that we need to know. So we need to know whether one bear is big and the other is small, whether one is old and the other young, whether they're equally motivated to fight, for example, if they're equally hungry, because it makes a difference whether one of the bears had a big meal and is not hungry versus the other. So one of the two bears, the one who's hungrier, is more motivated to fight. So these are all important things that need to be taken into consideration to understand how dominance actually works in the real world. Also, whether these two bears meet in isolation, or whether there's other bears surrounding them, whether these bears are willing to participate and maybe support one or the other. So these are all complexities that we do take into account as we create these models. And obviously, there are situations in humans involving, for example, groups of individuals and countries where things are not immediately similar to those in animals. But again, there are similar principles that can apply. So, for example, in resolving dominance in animals, there is an important role for bluffing. The fact that one animal can let the other know that he or she is willing to fight, even though that's not true. So you can pretend that you're really angry, that you're really about to attack, and you're not. So bluffing is something that is also used in large-scale confrontations between groups of people, between countries. So you might threaten to launch an attack to another country when you know that you have no intention of doing that. But bluffing, it's like, you know, dominance is a bit like playing poker. You know, the other player does not know what cards you have, and you can bluff. And whether the other player believes you or not, that might contribute to the settlement of the conflict through dominance.
You know, recently I had the opportunity to talk with E.O. Wilson, very famous biologist, and he has a new book out that he's now written recently, and I guess it's causing some controversy among people in evolutionary biology because it makes the following argument. He says that certainly it's true that people are motivated to maximize their own personal interest. Past that, they're also interested in taking care of their families. And that's certainly something that you write about in the book. So we're interested in advancing the success of our children, and then perhaps past that are people who are related to us. The thing that he argues that's caused all the controversy is that he takes it up another level, and he says among social animals, and I think he argues that you can see it in ants and in bees and then also in humans, that people actually are willing to make sacrifices for individuals that are not related to them. And he makes this argument that, in fact, a very important driving force in evolution is the group, and that what people are interested in is not just maximizing their own benefit and their children's benefits, but if they're part of a band or a tribe or a group, that they're also willing to do things that will benefit the group. And this is, you know, people have been arguing about this and saying they think he's right or that they think he's not. I'm interested in what you have to say about that.
Yeah, I haven't read E.O. Wilson's book, but from what I heard, yeah, he seems to promote this view that group selection has played a more important role in human evolution than other scientists, other biologists are willing to believe.
Right.
So he seems to have changed his mind a little bit over over the topic, because he was one of the major proponents of individual selection instead, the fact that individuals mainly act so as to maximize their own benefits. So this is obviously a controversial topic in evolutionary biology. Group selection is a real phenomenon. So the idea, as you mentioned, that individuals who live in group can act in ways so as to sacrifice themselves for the sake of the group, even if the group includes individuals who are not related, who are not family members. So there are no evolutionary biologists who believe that this phenomenon is not real, it doesn't exist. The controversy is over how important, how frequent this phenomenon is. So E.O. Wilson's view is a minority view. So the vast majority of evolutionary biologists believe that most social processes, most evolutionary processes in the animal kingdom, including humans, are really the result of natural selection acting at an individual level. So the circumstances in which a phenomenon like group selection could operate are very rare. So group selection could work, but under very particular and specific circumstances, which don't happen very often. So, for example, a group in which you have these altruists who sacrifice themselves must be isolated from other groups, because as evolutionary biologists say, a group that is full of altruists like this is vulnerable to being invaded by somebody who's selfish. If somebody who's selfish joins a group of altruists, he will take advantage of the altruists and will benefit immensely. So there's all kinds of things that need to happen for group selection to be an important process. And most evolutionary biologists don't think that these circumstances happen very frequently.
All right. We're talking this morning in this hour of focus with Daria Mastropieri from the University of Chicago. We're talking about the social behavior of humans and of our closest animal relatives and how similar they are, something he writes about in his book, Games Primates Play. And we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, why we're getting fat. One-third of Americans are obese, another third are overweight. Kelly Brownell explains why changes in eating habits and our sedentary lifestyles pose serious threats to adults and children. He's one of the experts featured in a new HBO documentary series about obesity called The Weight of a Nation. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic, proud to be a part of Champaign-Urbana and our surrounding communities for more than 80 years. Starting from a single Champaign location, Christie now serves patients from 14 clinic locations. More about Christie Clinic in your community is at ChristieClinic.com.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. We're here Monday through Friday from 10 until noon. We have two different subjects for you every day. And let me mention that tomorrow we'll have something of a practical nature. We hope that maybe we'll help some folks. Rick Karch will be with us. He's an auto mechanic, has a business in Champaign called Rick's Automotive, and occasionally he's here. And we encourage people to call in and tell us about their car problems, and he'll see if he can help. In the second hour, the guest is Denise Cummins. She is adjunct professor of psychology and philosophy at the U of I. We'll talk about her book, Good Thinking, Seven Powerful Ideas That Influence the Way We Think, which takes a look at how it is that people say, or who are psychologists think, or people who are economists think, or people who are philosophers think. And her idea is that there's not a lot of crossover between those areas, and that it would be probably a good idea for, say, the economists to understand the psychologists and vice versa. So that's what the book is about. Then also, let me give you one more. Wednesday morning at 10, we'll be talking about the enormous student debt that we have in this country, how we got to this point, and what we should do about it. And the guest will be Lauren Asher, president of the Institute for College Access and Success. We're here weekday mornings, as I say, 10 to noon. You can check the schedule by going to the website, which is will.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. Our guest in this hour of focus is Dario Mastropieri. He's professor of comparative human development, evolutionary biology, neurobiology, and psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at the University of Chicago. And we're talking about what some of the things you'll find in his recent book, Games Primates Play, taking a look at primate social behavior and human social behavior and how much alike they are. Questions are welcome. Maybe we return just to the subject of nepotism, because that's something we were headed towards and you write about in the book. And again, this has to do with the fact that individuals will do what they can to promote their progeny. That's a natural thing we see. That's something we certainly see in humans, and that's the word that we use to describe it.
Yeah, nepotism is a universal phenomenon in the animal world. To a biologist, nepotism simply means to act in ways that favor your family members at the expense of unrelated individuals. It's a universal phenomenon because there isn't a single species, or a single human society for that matter, in which individuals favor unrelated individuals at the expense of their own family members. So whenever there is a bias, it's in favor of family members. Now, nepotism can be weak or strong. In some species, it's stronger. In some human societies, it's stronger than in others. And typically, this depends on whether the society, the people are rich or poor, whether there's a lot of resources or not. Because when people are rich, they don't worry so much about having to take the extra step to help their family members. There's less need for that. But when the resources are scarce and people have to tighten their belt, then that's when the need for helping relatives is greater. So, for example, American society was founded on the principles of meritocracy and equal opportunity, and nepotism wasn't a major concern in American society for a long time. But now that we're struggling with economic crisis and the crisis of the job market and unemployment and things like that, we see a resurgence of nepotism. So we see, for example, that baby boomers, who right now hold a lot of power and wealth, go out of their way to try and help their children, who are right now just entering the workforce, to try and land good jobs or obtain resources. So we see a resurgence of nepotism in social processes and also in economics.
Mm-hmm. The book, I think, broadly divides into two areas. One, it does indeed have to do with competition, at least in the sense of dominance, and the other has to do with how it is that people establish bonds and relationships with each other. One hopes towards some mutual benefit, even though one person might get a little bit more out of it than the other. And so that brings us to the subject of love and a bonding between mating pairs. And again, here, I think what's interesting is that if you look at the behavior of other animals, there are certainly animals that establish pair bonds, but there are also a lot of animals where they come together for the purposes of reproduction. They do that, and then they go off. There's no kind of lasting relation between the individuals. And so that brings one to this question, well, why is it that in humans we form these bonds and that there are these deep emotional connections that people form?
Yeah, I think evolutionary biologists have come up with a really good explanation as to why in some species, as you said, a male and a female form long-term bonds and raise their offspring together, whereas in others, they just mate and reproduce, and then they don't stay together. And the explanation has to do with whether or not offspring need assistance from both parents. So in more than half the species of birds, parents form a long-term bond. And the reason for that is that the offspring would not be able to make it if a single parent tried to do all the work. So the principle is that whenever offspring need both parents, the parents tend to stick together. So in humans, in theory, a single parent could raise a child or more than one. But it's hard, and it's become increasingly more difficult in complex human societies where having the help and support of two parents and maybe an extended family can really make a difference for a child, make a difference between a good life or a bad life. So, but this doesn't speak to the issue of love. I think love is a unique, is a phenomenon, is an emotion, a feeling that is unique to humans. So I think that other animals form long-lasting pair bonds, but I don't think that they experience the feeling of love the way we do. So that's another interesting question. Why is it that humans have evolved love and others have not? And I address this question in the book.
Well, and does that go beyond just the we'll say, well, it's a mechanism that helps bond people together for the purpose of of raising offspring and hopefully seeing them succeed. Is it more than that?
It's a lot about that. I think that without feelings of love, I think that if we lived in a world in which people could have sex, but they wouldn't experience any feelings of love, probably there wouldn't be any long-term couples. So I think that love motivates people to be together and to stay long enough probably to raise successfully a child or more together. Obviously, there are couples in love who don't have children, couples of the same sex who experience love. So obviously, love is the same. But the question is, why did love evolve to begin with? But nobody agrees with this. Not everybody agrees with this explanation. So In my book, I mention another explanation that has been advanced to explain why love evolved. And this was the suggestion of an economist, Bob Frank, who's a professor at Cornell, who writes a column for the Wall Street Journal. And he wrote a book years ago in which he argued that romantic love evolved to solve the commitment problem, which is a problem that arises in all cooperative relationships. So whether it's a business partnership or a romantic partnership, the idea is that at some point, things change in a relationship, and these benefits and costs change, so that even though at the beginning it's advantageous to both individuals to be in the relationship, at some point it becomes disadvantageous for one individual to stay in the relationship. But there are other individuals who might be affected if the relationship ends, such as children or other partners. And so Frank suggests that romantic love evolved to solve this commitment problem, essentially to keep two people together regardless of the benefits and the costs, regardless of whether they gain or lose. It's an irrational force that just keeps people together. And I criticize this idea. I don't think that that's the reason why romantic love evolved.
Okay. We have some other callers here. Let's talk with some other folks here. And next we'll talk with someone in Urbana. And this is line number one. Hello.
Hello. Do you view your work and your interpretation of it as supportive of social Darwinism, which is the idea stated crudely that of the survival of the fittest, and the people who rise to the top in wealth and power and dominance because they are better biological specimens. I'll sign off. Thank you.
All right.
No, I don't think that what I do or my views or ideas support social Darwinism in any way, at least what most people think the social Darwinism means. So first of all, evolutionary biology aims to explain, you know, human behavior. So essentially provides these explanations that assume that we have biological tendencies to behave in certain ways. So, for example, tendencies to establish dominance in competitive situation and so forth. But biology is not destiny. So biology really doesn't have much to offer in terms of policy or in terms of the rules that we create to regulate our life in our society. So, it might be that biology describes some of the things that happen in society, but humans have the ability to choose not to to behave in ways that are consistent with their biological predisposition. So biology is not destiny, is not meant to inform policy, is not meant to inform, you know, lawmakers or government. People choose to have forms of government that have little to do with biology, and that's okay.
All right, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Let's go to another caller here, Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Yeah, I think I learned on this show about the bonobo factor and the idea that primatologists found one of the most aggressive in pairing and other factor in the chimpanzee. Maybe the bonobos were further in the woods, but apparently they have a different way. They aren't either or strong pair bonding, and they aren't monadic, or whatever the word would be. They purposely apparently are promiscuous, and they can't establish whose kids are whose, basically. And there's a group identity that comes from that, and I just want to know how you how you counter that part of the primate evidence.
Yeah, so with we're closely related to both chimpanzees and bonobos. And even though we share many aspects of their behavior, chimpanzees and bonobos differ in one characteristic, which is that chimpanzees tend to be more aggressive than bonobos. And there's an explanation for that. There is an explanation for variation in how aggressive a particular animal species is, including humans. And biologists explain variation in aggression with the way animals compete for resources. So, for example, the way they compete for food, the way males compete for females. So if it's advantageous to compete in an aggressive way because you get a lot out of being aggressive and you don't pay a high cost for being aggressive, then you see a lot of aggressiveness in the species. If instead it's not advantageous to be aggressive because, for example, there's plenty of food that can be shared, or being aggressive towards females does not really bring any advantages in terms of mating more with these females, then there's no point in being aggressive, or if there's a high cost associated with aggression. So, chimpanzees and bonobos are different, and every animal species is different from all the others. Every animal species is unique. So when we study primates, we do so not to find one particular species that is more similar to humans so that we can draw direct parallels. So every species is unique. We study primates to understand the general principles that can be applied to human behavior. So there are principles that can be extracted from the study of both chimpanzees and bonobos, and we can learn a lot about human nature by looking at these primates. But neither species is better as a model for humans than the other.
But if you have conflicting phenomena, it's harder to draw a general principle, and it's harder to make the kind of observations or insights into animal cross behavior. I was also thinking there might be a biological Heisenberg thing about maybe the chimpanzees were closer to where humans were, and there was inner primate aggression which helped form them to be more aggression. So but that's just a bit of an aside. But I just think that this just highlights the limits of this type of argument from the nature of the species, the various different. And
I think that you're right because we need to be very cautious when we identify one primate species, for example, and we start making parallels between humans and that particular species. Because, as I said, every species is unique, and there's other species that operate in different ways. So if I just use one particular species, chimpanzees, to make my case that humans have a long evolutionary history that's reflecting that behavior, I would be wrong, because chimpanzees, even though they share with us an ancestor 5 or 6 million years ago, they have evolved in these 5-6 million years, so they're very different from the way our ancestor was. So every species is unique. The fact that bonobos and chimpanzees are different does not mean that we cannot extract principles. As I said, we can explain why one species is more aggressive than the other by knowing how they compete for food, how they compete for mating, what their social dynamics are, what their body size is. So we can understand and make sense of these differences and still learn something useful that can help us understand the way we behave.
Yeah. You know, I've had more than one conversation with Franz Duval, who is a scientist who I think maybe more than anyone else has worked to bring the message of the bonobo out to the general public and introduce them to this other species that, in contrast to the chimpanzee, is less aggressive, is very sexual, uses sex often as a way of reducing conflicts and establishing bonds. And I think then presented with those two models, and what people want to do is they want to say, okay, which are we? And I think he has said on this program, he said, well, we're both.
Or neither.
I mean, it's you can't. We're not one or the other. That somehow we're maybe some. We have both tendencies, and so we're not purely aggressive. We're not purely loving. We're some of each.
Yes, I agree with that.
Another caller here, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I think a point needs to be clarified. You've already stated that social Darwinism has been largely discredited, I believe, and I think most scientists and informed people would agree with that. But the theory of natural selection that Darwin posited was not that the best would survive, but the fittest would survive. And this may mean that in some senses a lesser evolved creature will survive where a more evolved or apparently superior creature will not survive. There's the well-known phenomenon of miniaturization on islands where a less fit animal in normal situations, a pygmy elephant, I don't know that there is such a thing, but a small lion or tiger, because of the lesser food requirements, will survive, and there'll be a tendency to grow smaller. But this animal would not survive on a mainland environment. And some animals seem not to evolve at all because they are splendidly fitted to their environment. I don't think crocodiles have evolved very much over the last few hundred million years, have they? And
you're right.
The rhinoceros, I believe, has not evolved for about 60 million years. No, it can't be that long, 40 million. And I think this needs to be understood, that evolution doesn't necessarily mean better, but it means fitter. And
yes,
that's the point I wanted to clarify. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yes, so it's the environment that drives evolution. If the environment didn't change, there would be no need for organisms to change and to adapt. I don't think it's useful to speak of more evolved or less evolved organisms or superior or inferior organisms. As the caller said, the crucial issue is whether there is a fit with the environment. So as the environment changes, there are some organisms, some individuals that that fit well. They're better able to exploit that environment. They're better able to survive and better able to reproduce in that environment. And as a result of that, that will leave more copies of their genes to the next generation. And those instead who don't do as well after this change in the environment, they will not leave copies of their gene. This is evolution by natural selection. So there's a change in the environment, and some individuals, because of their genes, are better able to adjust to this new environment than others. That's all there is to it.
We're coming down to a couple of minutes left, and I was struck by an article that appeared just recently in the New York Times by James Atlas, and it was an observation that recently we have had a number of books, and yours wasn't mentioned, but I think yours would fit in, a number of books that are about thinking. They're about how the brain works. They're about how it is we make decisions and so forth. In fact, at least one of these people has been on this program. That was Charles Duhigg. We talked about his book, The Power of Habit. And there are another number of others mentioned here. And James Atlas writes here about these books. He writes, "These books possess a unifying theme. The choices we make in day-to-day life are prompted by impulses lodged deep within the nervous system. Not only are we not masters of our fate, we are captives of biological determinism. Once we enter the portals of the strange neuronal world known as the brain, we discover that, to put the matter plainly, we have no idea what we're doing." So I'm interested in your reaction to two things, sort of the idea of this biological determinism, but also why it is that it seems that at this moment, you know, you go into a bookstore and there are many books that are all like this. Why now, do you think?
I think there's there's been a general increase in interest in science in general, not just in psychology, in the human mind. But it's true that over the last few years, there have been a lot of books about the mind, about the way we think, about the way we make decisions. And part of the reason for that is that we've learned a lot more about the way the human mind works. And so we've learned, for example, that the human mind has all kinds of biases. all kinds of predispositions to make decisions, to act in one way or another. In some situations, these are good predispositions that help us make good decisions. In other cases, the mind essentially is biased towards making certain mistakes. But even these mistakes make sense. So by understanding why we make certain mistakes, we gain a better understanding of how the mind works. Now, the fact that we learn more about the brain doesn't necessarily mean that we have a more biologically deterministic view of the mind. So you might say that the fact that we recognize that there's biological propensities to think or behave in certain ways might somewhat undermine the notion of free will. And this is something that I talk about in my book, the fact that in some cases, we seem to make decisions sort of on an automatic pilot without any consciousness. And the fact that we consciously think about the decision is a bit of an afterthought. But we're still in control. We still have the power to inhibit these tendencies that we have. We still have the power to say, no, I don't want to do this. We're still in control. So I wouldn't speak of biological determinism.
So it's still the difference is that we, yes, it is true that we, our brains work in these ways, we think in these ways, we make decisions in these ways. But at the, but you can say, one can say, well, while that's true, it is possible for us to be aware, to understand how that works. And there always is, as you say, there always is the option for us to say, no, I see that, I'm moving this way, but you can always say, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, so the fact that we recognize that in some cases we make unconscious decisions doesn't necessarily imply that there is no role for conscious decisions, okay? So there's both. There is the unconscious and the fact that in some cases we have biases that push us in certain directions, but there is also conscious decisions. There's rational thinking. We plan ahead. We think about our future. We pretty much choose our own environment. We make our own future. So there's a lot of room for that.
All right. Our guest in this hour of focus, Dario Maestropieri, is professor of comparative human development and evolutionary biology at the University of Chicago. His book is Games Primates Play. It is published by Basic Books. We want to say thanks to him, and also thanks to Eric Fry, who's the technician on the other end there at the University of Chicago. And Professor Maestropieri, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.